From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, leaders of some of the great big bands, Artie Shaw, Woody Herman, and Mercer Ellington. Mercer Ellington has conducted his father's orchestra ever since Duke Ellington's death in 1974. Also today, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Widow's Peak. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton, in Europe to commemorate the 50th anniversary of D-Day, talked briefly by telephone with South Korea's president today. Both men reportedly agreed some type of sanctions must be imposed against North Korea for its refusal to allow full inspections of its nuclear plants. Meanwhile, in Washington, a meeting on North Korea is underway at the State Department. UPI's Bill Small has the story.
Assistant Secretary of State Robert Gallucci says the U.S. has begun talks with South Korea and Japan on sanctions against North Korea, and he rejects North Korea's assertion that it would consider the imposition of sanctions an act of war. Gallucci saying the Koreans have been warned of the possibility for a year or more.
That North Korean statements now are utterly inappropriate. Beyond being inappropriate, I will tell you that we will not be intimidated by them. I don't expect the international community to be intimidated by them.
Gallucci says work on sanctions will proceed, and that just in case, the U.S. has taken the steps it needs to in order to defend South Korea. Bill Small, Washington.
In Rwanda, the U.N. has suspended evacuations of civilians from Kigali after a truck full of refugees was hit today by rebel gunfire. Meanwhile, a team of U.N. human rights experts goes to Rwanda next week to try to determine who's responsible for massacres that have killed some 500,000 people. The group will spend 2 weeks in Rwanda and will be guarded heavily. The team then reports to U.N. Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali. On Thursday, Boutros-Ghali complained that the world has been paralyzed towards Rwanda a full 2 months after the chaos began. He told the Security Council there was strong evidence that Rwanda's interim government was behind much of the killing. The Labor Department reports the nation's unemployment rate dropped in May to a surprisingly low 6%. Labor Secretary Robert Reich said he was pleased and that the administration was well on its way to meeting a target of 8 million new jobs.
The data today are indeed very good news for American workers. We have created, on our journey to 8 million new jobs, we are ahead of schedule. In 16 months, over 3 million jobs have been added to the American economy, over 93% in the private sector.
Economists say today's report shows the economy is not overheating because the number of new jobs created was lower than expected. The FBI is reportedly investigating charges that the General Electric Corporation hid test results that showed flaws in 7,000 aircraft engines. A Cleveland newspaper says the probe concerns GE's Evendale, Ohio plant. The Cleveland plane dealer says problems with the engine's electricity may produce fires or a sudden loss of power. The engines are used on passenger airlines, military planes, and on Air Force One. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 12.61 at 3771.60 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Virginia Republican Party holds its nominating convention this weekend to choose a candidate for U.S. Senate. The event has attracted hundreds of reporters because Iran-Contra figure Oliver North is one of the candidates. North's main rival is former Reagan budget director James Miller. For several months, the two have waged a campaign full of personal attacks, including Miller's hints that North might be mentally unfit to serve in the Senate. Virginia's senior senator, Republican John Warner, is openly fighting North's candidacy. Warner says if North wins, he'll support an independent candidate, Marshall Coleman. The UN says Bosnian Serb forces have reduced their numbers around the eastern Muslim enclave of Garajda, but have not completed a withdrawal that would allow peace talks to go ahead today in Geneva. Richard Carruthers reports from Zagreb.
The UN says there are still about 50 armed Serbs, most in civilian clothing, inside the two-mile exclusion zone around Gorazda. They're defying a month-old UN Security Council resolution and a NATO ultimatum. There was a partial pullout overnight. Bosnian Serb policemen in uniform are no longer manning checkpoints. But the United Nations says the Geneva peace talks, already delayed, cannot start until all the Serbs withdraw. UN Special Envoy Yasushi Akashi, who will chair the talks, has spoken optimistically about beginning tomorrow. A Bosnian government delegation is setting off for Geneva, but says it won't discuss a ceasefire until the Serbs leave Gorazda. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
The Archbishop of Canterbury today warned against romanticizing the upcoming 50th anniversary of D-Day. President Clinton joins other Allied leaders tomorrow in Britain for a religious service and military parade marking the day when the Allies invaded France. In an interview, Archbishop George Carey said it was right to reflect on D-Day, but not to romanticize it because it caused much pain and destruction. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On today's archive program, we feature leaders of some of the great big bands. When Duke Ellington died in 1974, his son Mercer took over the band. Much of Mercer Ellington's life was spent working with the orchestra. As a young man, he was the gopher. In 1950, he played briefly with the orchestra, and in 1964, he rejoined as a trumpeter and road manager. Mercer also wrote several compositions that became part of the orchestra's repertoire, including Blue Surge and Jumpin' Punkins. His best-known composition is Things Ain't What They Used to Be. This version was recorded live at the 1959 Newport Jazz Festival with Duke Ellington conducting. It must have been difficult for Mercer Ellington to establish his own musical identity, growing up in the shadow of one of America's greatest composers. When I spoke with Mercer in 1989, I asked if his father's death helped liberate Mercer as a composer.
You would think that it would have, but that's not true, really. I mean, I'm under the same restriction as far as competition is concerned. Competition with myself, early Mercer Ellington, and competition, with Duke Ellington, with the same problem he had. The things that he's written are so perennial that all our audiences request many of the tunes from the past, and they have such a great warmth and a great charm that you have to do them. And, you know, can you imagine us doing a concert, say, without playing Satin Doll or Mood Indigo or Sophisticated Ladies?
When your father was alive and you wrote a composition, something like, say, Things Ain't What They Used to Be, would he listen to it and then critique it for you?
No. In fact, it was funny you should pick that particular tune because he called me up. He knew I was out in the street playing around, and he laid for me. He had the clerk in the hotel to give him a ring when I came in, which is about 4:30. And I had been complaining because I wasn't getting the opportunity to write anything and do anything about it. So he waited, and at 4:30 he called me and says, we have a session at 9 o'clock. I want you to do a side for me. I just reached for everything and anything I could find and threw it out there at him. And I've been trying to write like that ever since.
What was his reaction to it when he heard it?
His reaction was always, his compliment was always silence. His negative reaction was a suggestion. Well, you might have done this, or do you think this is possible? Or whatever. And much as it was the case with him as an individual, to bring him to a point of decision or to get him to make an absolute statement called for a certain kind of treatment that you had to give him. I'd be in the dither as to how to get from one town to the other, whether to charter the bus, whether we should fly or take the train. If I asked him, what should I take, I'd never get an answer. So my way of invoking a decision from him would be, well, Pop, tomorrow we're going to get up at 9 o'clock and take the train out to Philadelphia. And he said, well, what's wrong with the airplane? Then I knew we could fly.
You played in the Ellington Band, didn't
yes.
you? How long did you play?
I was with them for 1 year in 1950 and left to form a record company. And then again, I joined them in 1967 to stay.
Did you have to audition to get in?
No. I guess the word is con my way into the orchestra. When I got in there as a trombone player, they were very short of musicians because the business was so good. Everybody who was a soloist could have his own band. But later, he needed a road manager. And all his friends had turned him down because they said they wanted to remain his friend. And the last man he could think of was me, so he called me up and said, I want you to be the road manager. I knew what trouble he'd had in trying to find someone. I said, yeah, I'll do it, on the proviso that I play trumpet as I do the road manager. So he put me in as a fifth wheel. Actually, I was a fifth wheel. There were five trumpets there at the time.
And that's how you became the road manager, too.
Right.
You ended up being the manager of a band where you knew all the musicians since your childhood. And
which is the worst handicap you can have.
Yeah, because they probably thought of you as the kid, even though you weren't the kid anymore.
And it wasn't that so much. It was just one of those things. They thought of me as the gopher. That was my first job.
So you'd have to run out and get stuff.
I still have it. I have every job left that I started out with. I still go get the sandwiches. I help with the baggage. I help set up the bandstand. And I have to do the copying and also make arrangements.
Was it understood when your father was getting older that you would take over the band after he died?
Absolutely not. I mean, it never occurred to him. It never occurred to me. Only thing, if it had occurred to me, I would have studied piano much more seriously than I did. But all I cared about was getting into the orchestra. And I knew if I played piano, that wouldn't happen.
Mercer Ellington is my guest, and he's conducted the Duke Ellington Orchestra since Mercer's father's death in 1974. Can you tell us what a rehearsal would be like with Duke Ellington?
Well, first off, the 2 o'clock rehearsal got started around about 3:15. And then the guys would come in. They would put down the music and start playing it. And it would sound like the worst thing in the world. By the third playing of it, it took on a sound which was completely different and completely identifiable as something that could only be Duke Ellington. And it depended on what he thought of it and what the purpose of what he was rehearsing was for. Many times, for no reason at all, he would rehearse a tune and spend 5 or 6 hours on just one number. And on another occasion, he would just play the number twice and find that the engineers didn't get it properly if we were in a record date. And then he declared, well, okay, that's enough time on that because now the feeling is gone and the soloist can't come up with the same emotion that he had on the first time of playing it. So he'd abandon it until we got to the next studio and next rehearsal, go over it again, studio, rehearsal, until one day he decided, well, now we got the one that's right. So that a rehearsal with Ellington was never something that was like systematic or that you knew there would be some form of methodology that would be called for.
You are, with the Duke Ellington Orchestra, playing some of Ellington's neglected works, some of the extended works, as well as some of his most popular compositions. When you take out a work that hasn't been played in a long time and you're looking at the score, is it difficult to read? And I ask you that because in a memoir that you wrote about your father, Duke Ellington, you say that he frequently wrote really cryptically because he was afraid that people would steal his composition, which was, I guess, pretty common then, that people would steal other people's ideas. So he'd write it so it couldn't be stolen that easily. Are you stuck with having to decipher that now?
No, not really, because I did so much copying that I recognized his symbols and all the little things he did to disguise the music. For instance, one of them would be to write a part and put the wrong clef sign on it. So if somebody had started naming the notes, they'd have it completely messed up. The other thing was to use, this cryptic titling on numbers so that if you heard a number and you wanted to get it out of the book, like, for instance, you know, he'd make an arrangement that would say a new concept of In My Solitude, you'd never find it. If you wanted to say, he did a tune called Squeeze Me. Well, on one occasion, it would be titled Slew Slew. And then another time, he called it Subtle Slough. So if you looked in the in the music to try to, say, take the parts out and copy them over or get some kind of idea of what was happening, you couldn't recognize the tune by the writing that was on it. Well, because the saxophones had one name on it and the trombones had another, and you could never really piece them together.
So how common was stealing through sheet music?
Well, in the days, I mean, it was very blatant at one point. And even in the old Cotton Club days, the guys from downtown would come in with their pencils in their hands and just blatantly sit there with the music and sit in the front row copying down what they heard.
It's amazing. In Music Is My Mistress, your father's collection of memoirs and reminiscences about musicians, he wrote a couple of pages about you, and he started it by saying, "My son Mercer Ellington is dedicated to maintaining the luster of his father's image." Did you ever feel that he perhaps took that for granted?
No, but what he's doing, in essence, he was saying something in print that he could never say to me individually. And it was not necessarily meant for the reader as much as it was meant for me, because he had the difficulty of being able to talk intimately to me. I have the same difficulty. If I had to say to my wife or my children or something else that they did something I liked, I'd find it difficult to make the statement. I think this was his way of expressing approval of what of many of the things I had done, or saying thanks for having done it.
Since so many people know you as the son of Duke Ellington, are people surprised when they find out that you're getting older yourself? You were born in 1919. Do you know what I mean? I think in a lot of people's eyes, you're going to be just perpetually very young.
Ellington has caused a tremendous oversight on my age for quite a while. In the old days, he used to say he didn't want anyone to know he had a son with gray hair because it might keep the chicks away. And then he's still at it even as of now, because I told people, and we had quite a do, you know, in celebrating his 90th birthday. And so they all got to where, we got around and took care of each other and everything like that. And all of a sudden they said something about, "Well, you shouldn't be tired." I explained to them, I said, "You've all been so busy celebrating Duke Ellington's 90th birthday that you've forgotten that I'm on my 70th. And I'd like to get some sleep for a change."
Mercer Ellington, I thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much for joining us on Fresh
Air. It's been very pleasant, Terry.
Mercer Ellington recorded in 1989. He's now preparing to record his father's opera Queenie Pie for Motown Records. This summer, Mercer will lead the Ellington Orchestra at major jazz festivals around the world. We'll feature an interview from the archives with the late Woody Herman after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring interviews from our archives with leaders of the great big bands. Woody Herman was an accomplished clarinet and saxophone player, but his greatest achievement was as a band leader, directing innovative soloists and arrangers. ¶¶ That's Woodchopper's Ball, the record which the Woody Herman Band first became known for. Herman organized his first band in 1937, during the height of the big band era, and kept together his band, the Thundering Herd, long after that era ended. He stayed on the road until failing health made travel impossible. Herman died of congestive heart failure, emphysema, and pneumonia in 1987 at the age of 74. I spoke with him in 1986, when he was still on the road. He told me that he started his long performing career as a child in vaudeville.
I was a song and dance kid. And then with the money I made from the first or second road tour, I've forgotten, I got my first saxophone and then later a clarinet and started to study with local teachers in Milwaukee.
Had you heard jazz then?
No, I didn't hear jazz really or become aware of it until I got into the teenage stage of life. But when I announced to my mother and father that I was no longer in showbiz and that I was leaving it forever and I was about to embark on a jazz musician's career, I think they both went into a dead faint because as long as I was in the theater, that seemed safe to them. But being a jazz musician, just like the word jazz, was thought of as a very bad, dirty kind of thing.
This is amazing. First of all, so many parents wouldn't want their kids in showbiz because they think that was unsafe.
Yes.
And then your parents didn't want you in jazz. So
I think everybody has a different concept of what success is.
You've said that you've never thought of yourself as a great clarinetist. How do you feel about the instrument?
I don't like the instrument. I don't think I ever did. I think it's a very difficult, too difficult instrument to express yourself properly.
If you dislike the clarinet so much, how come you played it? Because you also were a saxophonist.
Well, it was the American boy's instrument in the 30s and 40s. You know, it was if you didn't have a clarinet and stood in front of the band, well, what are you there for? It was almost at that point.
There's a lot of musicians that really got started in your band. And just to tick off a few, Stan Getz, Al Cohn, Zoot Sims, Jimmy Giuffre.
Right. The Four Brothers, so were some of the people that later came on the scene.
What do you look for? How do you audition someone? Let's start with the 30s and 40s. How did you then go about finding people?
Then it was really less difficult if there was somebody that you really liked. And if they were working for someone else, you try to get them to join your band because you were trying to play new things and probably more musical things. And those that wanted to progress joined us. And I think that was a big come on as far as guys were concerned.
The band that you led in the 30s and the early 40s, mm-hmm. you described as a cooperative band that was an
right.
offshoot of the Isham Jones Band. What was the first band that you really thought of as being yours?
Well, let me tell you why that band was changed, and there was a different kind of evolution took place, but it was because of wartime. And as people were drafted out and went into the service, we had to get different kind of people or new people or people who we thought would work for us. And then I decided that it was now my sole responsibility and I wanted to do more progressive music than we were doing in the earliest days. And I wanted to improve. I wanted the band to improve and be one that could play all kinds of music and do it well.
Another thing that made that band unique was that it was a big band that was playing harmonies and rhythms that came out of bop, and I think a lot of the big bands really were resisting
that. They weren't
that.
Interested, and I was. So, as a matter of fact, our whole band, shortly before we went into the second herd, if you want to call it that, the Four Brothers herd, I insisted that our whole band that we would go to hear Charlie Parker at his opening. On 52nd Street with Dizzy and a few of our friends, because Dizzy was already writing for our band.
Was it hard to figure out how to incorporate the rhythmic and harmonic innovations of bop into a big band setting?
Well, I think you had to have imagination, and I think that you... In other words, there's two kinds of music, as Ellington said many times, and certainly Stravinsky said it to me personally. Two kinds of music, good and bad, and we were definitely trying to play good.
Mm-hmm. Second Herd, which was your second band, you organized that in 46 or 47.
47.
And this was just about the time that a lot of the big bands were
That's
starting
to fold.
They
all disappeared, yeah.
Yeah, so you were really going against the tide then by organizing
ways.
A big band, yeah.
Well, everybody left except Ellington, Basie, and maybe Harry James. And everyone else just took a run for it, and mostly. And
was it hard to keep the bands going? Is that why so many of them disappeared?
Yeah, well, financially it was a bust. It was no longer a business. It was now a hobby, and if you could afford it, you did it.
How were you able to do it?
Because I made it a hobby. And I've suffered the consequences ever since, you know. I got into trouble in later with the IRS, and I'm still in trouble with them at this late date.
You once said that what would have made the best financial sense would have been after 1946 or so to take your money and invest it, not invest it in a band, invest it.
Yeah, oh, of course, yeah.
But obviously you've put music first.
Well, it's been above everything in my lifetime, so sometimes it's been a disservice to me as a person. But that's beside the point, because I still have that love and affection for music, and I'm still alive, I think, because of my love for music. And the Lord has been kind to me. Let's look at it that way.
Woody Herman recruited in 1986. He died the following year at the age of 74. This spring, his autobiography, Woodchopper's Ball, was republished by Limelight Editions. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Woody Herman's composition, Apple Honey, recorded by his band in 1945.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this archive edition, a 1985 interview with clarinetist and bandleader Artie Shaw about why he rebelled against some of the showbiz values of many big bands. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Widow's Peak, starring Joan Plowright, Mia Farrow, and Natasha Richardson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. ¶¶
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton spoke today by phone with South Korean President Kim Jong-sam. The White House says the two agreed they must impose some type of economic sanctions on North Korea as punishment for its rejection of full international inspections of nuclear facilities. Meanwhile, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency reports to the UN Security Council today on his efforts in North Korea. Also, officials from the U.S., South Korea, and Japan are meeting at the State Department on possible sanctions. President Clinton today visited the graves of American soldiers who died during the Italian campaign of World War II. He walked among the rows and rows of white crosses that mark the gravesites of 7,800 Americans who died in combat from Sicily to Rome. The president then spoke to a crowd of about 1,000 U.S. veterans.
We stand today in fields forever scarred by sacrifice. Today, it is hard to imagine that. This is now a place of peace. It is lush with the pines and the cypresses. But 50 years ago, when freedom was in peril, this field ran with the blood of those who fought to save the world.
Among the veterans at the ceremony were four U.S. senators, Daniel Inouye, Bob Dole, Claiborne Pell, and Ernest Hollings. The Labor Department says unemployment dropped 0.4% last month to 6%. The number of new jobs grew by 191,000, less than what most analysts expected. They say that means the economy is growing more slowly than before. That should please stock traders worried about the economy overheating and causing inflation. Virginia Republicans are gathering in Richmond for a two-day convention to choose the party's candidate for the U.S. Senate race. The main contenders are former Reagan budget director Jim Miller and Oliver North, a central figure in the Iran-Contra scandal. NPR's David Malpas reports.
Nearly 15,000 delegates will take part in the convention. Oliver North claims at least 57% of them are in his camp. Most outside observers predict North will win, but some expect tomorrow's vote will be close. Miller has the backing of much of the party establishment, and polls show he has the best shot at capturing the Senate seat for the Republicans in November's general election. Meanwhile, North has been subjected to a barrage of criticism within his own party as untrustworthy and a fanatic. But the attacks only seem to have solidified North's base among hard-right elements of the GOP who have increased their control of the party machinery. For many of these Virginia Republicans, the charismatic North has achieved celebrity status from his feisty crusade against what he calls Washington's professional elite. I'm David Malpas reporting.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 13.23 points to close at 3772.22. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR. The UN's food agency says starvation is imminent in Rwanda. Aid workers say there's some food in warehouses in Kigali, but they can't get to it because of the fighting there. The civil war has also hurt farming, already in trouble because of drought last year. A UN convoy evacuating civilians from the Rwandan capital Kigali came under fire today. As a result, the UN suspended its operation, but not before about 250 people were helped to safety. The BBC's Mark Doyle reports.
The convoys crossed at a strategic roundabout in the center of town. The one heading for the rebel side arrived without incident, and there was much hugging and cheering as the mainly Tutsi passengers met their relatives for the first time in 2 months. The convoy heading for the government side was, however, fired on. It's not clear which side shot first, nor the motive, but the UN has now again suspended humanitarian operations until it gets fresh guarantees of security. The small UN operation in Rwanda is very limited in its activities because of lack of troops and equipment. The rebel side has criticized the UN for not doing enough, especially for not stopping the massacres of Tutsis and Hutu government opponents by the government militia.
Mark Doyle in Kigali. This weekend marks the fifth anniversary of the Chinese government massacre on democracy demonstrators in Tiananmen Square. Only one public protest is reported so far, a hunger strike by a couple whose son was killed by troops during the crackdown on June 3rd and 4th. The Beijing government has banned group activities all week and has ordered workers away from the square. Hotels are also barred from airing CNN. Officials apparently fear the network will show footage of the Tiananmen protests. Britain's Labour Party could do well in the upcoming European Parliament elections. A new Gallup poll finds Labour with one of the largest leads over the Conservatives ever. More than half of those surveyed said they support Labour. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're featuring leaders of some of the great big bands on this archive edition. In the 1930s and 40s, the Artie Shaw Band ranked with the Goodman, Dorsey, and Miller bands in popularity. The Shaw Band made one of its most popular records at its first recording session in 1938. It was a song by Cole Porter called Begin the Begin. Artie Shaw's huge popular success brought unexpected torments. He temporarily left music in 1939, frustrated with a performing career that he came to think of as 90% business and 10% art. That was neither the first nor the last time he left music. In 1954, Shaw began a nearly 30-year retirement from music and permanently gave up the clarinet. After writing two books and becoming a film producer, Shaw returned to music in 1980 to organize a new big band, although he chose another musician, Dick Johnson, to play the solo clarinet parts and front the band. Now Artie Shaw is in retirement. When I spoke with him in 1985, he told me why he recorded Begin the Begin. Keep in mind, it was a virtually unknown song when he recorded it.
It was one of Cole Porter's few flop tunes and from one of his very few flop shows, Jubilee. I happened to get to the theater on Friday, the show closed Saturday, and I just heard that tune, and it was done in a kind of Latin beat. And I liked the melody. It was a hell of a good song. It still is. And a very big departure from most popular songs of those days, which were 8-8, Bridge and 8, or 8-8 and then 8-8. I mean, 1-2, 1-2. So I heard the tune, and I came back, and I was looking for an identity for the band. I told you we were looking for good songs from sophisticated songwriters. So I said to Jerry Gray, let's do Begin the Begin. He didn't know what the tune was. We got a copy, and we sat down and worked out the arrangement that everybody now knows. And I had no idea it was going to, it was, you know, the other side of a record that we thought was going to be the big one. It's always been true. Sphenacy was the other side of a record we thought was going to be a big one. Nobody knows what's going to be the hit. I'll tell you an interesting story about Stardust, the record that I have. Harry Meyerson was then A&R man, whatever that is for, they didn't have A&R men, but he was a production manager for RCA Records in California. It was then Victor. He came to me one day and said, the company wants to try a stunt if you'd be willing to participate in. We'd like to do a two-sided version. They had 78s in those days, A and B side. We're going to do a side with no A, we're a record with no A or B. You and Tommy Dorsey are our two biggest sellers, and we want to put each of you on one side of the two-sided record, Stardust. Big song. We'd like to have each of you do your own version of it. Do whichever you want. You know, 3 1/4-minute version. So I did that. I had this string section with the band. Went in, made the record. I did a sketch. Lenny Hayton did the orchestration. And we put it together and went in, did one version, and left. Take one. And I said, it's not going to get any better, so we left. About 3 weeks later, I talked to Harry. I said, I heard Tommy was in. I hadn't spoken to him, but I heard he was in. Did he make his side? He said, no, he didn't. You're going to have to come and make 3 more sides so we can have a 4-record release. I said, why? He said, Tommy came in the studio with his men, and he said, let me hear what Artie did. So I played him the record. He heard it on those big speakers, and he said, I'm not going to get on the other side of that. he would have sold 16 million records if he got on this other side. But Tommy and I never had any invidiousness. We were very good friends, and he respected that record.
Did you like his band?
Tommy? Oh, he was a good musician. Tommy never made a bad record in his life. I thought he made some cheap shot things, but at his best, and I think everybody's got a right to be judged by his best, at his best, he was a phenomenal guy.
From your perspective, who were the best band leaders of that time?
Well, I don't know. You can't rate them in any order, but I would say the prominent ones were Dorsey, Goodman, myself, Basie, Ellington, Before that, there was Lunsford. Chick Webb was there. Fletcher wrote some nice arrangements, but his band never was all that good. He had some good players. He had Coleman, he had Tricky Sam, he had Louis Armstrong for a while. He had great players in his band. But as a band leader, he didn't have the kind of rigid, iron-like discipline you need to run a band.
The early bands that you played with were bands that you called entertaining bands. Like,
that's all there was. Yeah. There were no jazz bands then that you could make a living in. I mean, if you were lucky enough to be black, you could play jazz, because that's the only music they had in the ghettos. But I was playing in the white world. And in the white world, there was no room to play jazz and make a living. So I ended up at the best jobs there were, studio work. And there it got to be utterly incredible. You were playing things like Manhattan Merry-Go-Round, the Lucky Strike Hit Parade. Well, it's scary. You're playing as a true for true what they like. What was it true what they say about Dixie for 13 weeks in a row? That can be enough to drive any halfway decent musician clear out of his head.
You had said that when you were playing for the entertaining bands that you started to really hate the whole concept of showmanship.
I still do.
What were the kinds of showmanship antics that people in the band were called on to perform?
Glenn Miller's band waving the trombones around from side to side as they play, saxophones holding their instruments up in the air and doing everything but playing serious music. The guys in my band one night, I came back to the band. I'd left them for about 3 weeks. They were out on the road. And they were playing a tune that I wrote for the band called, an arrangement I made called Lady Be Good. At the end of the last chorus, the band does something, the saxophones do a fast kind of whinny trill, and the guys for kicks were holding their horns up, and the trombones were doing that, and I looked at them, I was appalled. I said, what are you guys doing? They said, oh, it's for fun. I said, the audience doesn't know it's fun. They think you're doing showmanship, and if we have to do showmanship, that means we're very insecure about the music. Sit down and respect what you do. If you don't, they won't. And they heard that.
One sign of success, I think, when you were performing is if people were dancing. What did you think of dancing? You have that famous comment that all jitterbuggers are morons.
I didn't say all.
Okay. did you not like it when people danced?
I don't care what they do. It has no meaning to me. What I care about is if they come there and buy a ticket and support the band. That's really all that matters. And if they like it, that's great. If they don't like it, I'm still doing what I got to do. Dancing is totally irrelevant. If you want to dance, a windshield wiper will do it. All you need is a beat. You don't need what we do, you know?
In the 30s and early 40s, a common question that people would ask was, well, who do you think is really the king? Is it Artie or Benny? Were you aware of that whole public competition?
How could
between
I not
and
be?
Goodman?
I was part of that controversy. But it makes no bloody sense. We weren't doing the same things. The fact is we played a clarinet. We each played a clarinet. But the music was different. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you an interesting little anecdote. I had occasion to talk to Benny about something once that I wanted to do, and I needed him, and I needed the Dorsey people, and I needed the Stan Kenton and Guy Lombardo and all of the big band leaders. And I got okay from everybody. Goodman didn't want to do it. And he kept asking me questions about clarinet players. What do you think about so-and-so? What do you think about this guy, that guy? I said, this guy's too schmaltzy, that guy's too rigid, knowing what he expected me to say, and I was zinging him a little bit. So I said, finally, Benny, you're too hung up on the clarinet. And he looked at me and says, that's what we do, isn't it? I said, no, I'm trying to play music. I'm not interested in clarinet. It's a means. It's an instrument. You use an instrument to do something with. And I saw a tiny light bulb go on in his eyes. I don't think he ever seriously considered the idea that the clarinet was a means, not an end.
We're featuring a 1985 interview with Artie Shaw. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Artie Shaw. When you were leading a jazz band, the bands were still pretty segregated. There were black bands and white bands.
In New York City, there was a local union, 802, white. Then there was a Harlem union for blacks. There was no way if you could mix. The only thing you could do on records now and then, you'd play with a black guy. I'd get on a record. There would be Coleman Hawkins there or Lester or whoever, Cozy Cole playing drums. Rarely was there a white. Well, there were no black band, black playing with white musicians.
Well, when you hired Billie Holiday, she was, I believe, the first black singer to perform with a white band.
Well, to work in a white band, steadily, sure, as a member of the band. She didn't come out as a specialty act. See, I mean, when Benny Goodman had, say, Lionel and Teddy Wilson, they came out as a separate thing. They weren't in the band. When I had Lips Page, he sat in the band. Roy Eldridge was in the band. I had Zooty Singleton in my band in 1937. Well, that was unheard of. We played the Million Dollar Pier. People said, isn't he a black man? I said, well, he's hardly that tan. But it was very, very nip and tuck. People used very, very angry at it.
Were there places you couldn't play with Billie Holiday?
No, no. We went to the South. That was difficult because Billie had a short fuse and people would say things about it and she would blow. So I always had a guy ready to spirit her away, put her in a bus and get her out because she would blow. She'd call a guy every kind of MF you could think of. And they didn't take that too well. See, they would refer to as, they would say, have the nigger wench sing another song. I couldn't believe my ears. I'd say, you mean Billy singing another song? No, the nigger wench. That's what they thought of her as.
Was there any pressure on you by the men in the band to not have any black performers in it? Did anyone ever say, look, you know, you're going to lose us?
Hell
gigs
no.
We can't
the
it.
Men loved her, and they loved Lips, and they loved Roy. I mean, these were sterling performers. I would have liked to have four of them, but about one was all I could handle. The people would not accept much more.
You enlisted during World War II and ended up playing with your band on
the Pacific
Front.
Yeah.
Did you know when you enlisted that you'd be mostly performing? Was that the arrangement that was made?
No, I had no idea what I was going to be doing. I was on the stage in Providence, Rhode Island. When I went back in the wings while a dance act went on, we were doing an hour show, as they called it. And the stagehand's radio was on, and we were hearing a hysterical announcer talking about the Japs having bombed Pearl Harbor. I had to go back out on stage. Just before I went out, I got a note from the manager, please announce that all military personnel is to report to its bases immediately. This was right near Newport, where there was a sub base, a naval base, an Air Force base, all that. So I went out on stage and did that, and about three-quarters of the house got empty. I hadn't realized, you know, you take it for granted, men were more and more people showing up in uniforms. World War II was out there, but it seemed somehow distant. And when the Japs attacked Pearl Harbor, I suddenly had to see myself. I got a kind of Satori view of myself going out there and saying, now, ladies and gentlemen, our next tune will be. It sounded so irrelevant to this conflagration that World War II represented to me that I thought, I can't do this. I did it, announced the tune. I think it was Stardust. And as the band started playing, I turned to Les Robinson, who was in the first row of saxophone players. He was the lead. And I said, Les, pass the word, 2 weeks' notice. Total impulse. And 3 weeks later, I was down on Church Street enlisting in the Navy. I just felt that there was no place for me as a civilian. This was the big experience of my life. Had to be part of it. I don't know, or I didn't at that time, know that much about why Hitler was there, but I knew we had something to do with it. And I figured no matter how he got there, we had to stop him. In any case, I joined the Navy, and I went in as an apprentice seaman, as low as you could get. I could have become a commander if I'd wanted to. I didn't know that. I knew Forrestal, who was then undersecretary. And when I joined up, I had seen him, and he said, if you get in trouble, come see me. Well, after about 6 or 8 weeks of minesweeper duty or Staten Island, this, that, and the other, I found myself doing what an apprentice seaman does. I thought the Navy would have enough rationality to put me into the job I could do best for them and then give me whatever rate or rank I needed for that. I was very naive, you know. I didn't realize that the military service doesn't operate rationally. They looked at one stripe or no stripe, and they gave me a swab the deck sailor. Well, that's kind of stupid. I was building shelves under a stairway to put mops and buckets on. So I went to see Forrestal. I went AWOL, went down there and saw him in his office. And he laughed, and he said, all right, I'll put you in touch with somebody. And I got in touch with the head of enlisted men, a man named Admiral Bledsoe. And he gave me carte blanche to get a band together. He said, what do you want to do? I said, what do you want me to do? He said, get a band together. It's the best you can do for us. Where? I said, where's the Navy? He said, in the Pacific. I said, okay. So he gave me total carte blanche. I enlisted a bunch of guys who were 1A and got the best band that ever was. That band was a tremendous band. We won the Esquire Poll and all that. We traveled all over the Pacific in places where the Bob Hopes couldn't go. We went to forward areas. We were on battleships. We were on aircraft carriers. We were all over the place.
Artie Shaw, recorded in 1985. This is his band's 1939 recording of Rose Room. Artie Shaw did the arrangement. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Noah Adams and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. What stories are you following, Noah?
Hi, Terry. The unemployment rate drops, goes down to 6%. In other news, there's a strike against General Motors by designers. I'll talk with Donald Katz. He's the author of a new book about the Nike company and the shoe marketing culture. Nike is selling $1 million worth of shoes every hour in this country. I'll speak with a World War II veteran who recalls entering Rome 50 years ago today, and with a doo-wop expert about a new collection, The Best of Doo-Wop, including Gloria and The Morse Code of Love.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The British director John Irvine might have been more famous by now if he'd stuck to making one kind of film. Instead, he's done everything, from war movies like The Dogs of War and Hamburger Hill, to gentle character studies like Turtle Diary. He's even made an Arnold Schwarzenegger action picture, Raw Deal. His latest film is turning into a small-scale arthouse success. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Widow's Peak.
The year is 1926. And the setting is Kilshannon, a small Irish town divided neatly in half. In the valley, there are the merchants, the workers, the bustle of the village. But up on the hill above the town, there's a peculiar upper class. It's an exclusive community of well-to-do women, almost all of them widows, who lost their husbands in the First World War. They spend their time on teas and cemetery visits and the upkeep of their stately homes. The ringleader of the community is played by Joan Plowright, who has, over the last few years, become something of a movie icon. Her face alone sums up all the forces of gentility, prudery, and stern judgment that the British Isles can muster. On Widow's Peak, she sets the rules. No children allowed, and no men, unless they pass her inspection. Her unemployed nephew, played by Adrian Dunbar, is one of the very few who do. All the ladies on the hill are rich, except one, Miss O'Hare, played with a lush Irish accent by Mia Farrow. Miss O'Hare is mysteriously accepted despite her poverty, but then she's transparently a woman with a secret. Even more mysterious is a newcomer to the peak, Mrs. Broom, played by Natasha Richardson, in a performance that emits great quantities of both light and heat. Richardson has never been sexier or more luminous on the screen, and no one who watches this movie will be surprised when, after a very short acquaintance, that eligible nephew played by Adrian Dunbar whisks her off to a sunny knoll to ask for her hand.
This is a likely spot.
Or what?
A proposal.
How did you know?
My late husband proposed to me in the Lake District. He believed water was romantic. Your own mother's never done saying that all men are alike, so...
Well, in that case, it should be like marrying the same man twice.
I came here to be rid of men.
Fortune hunters. That excludes me. We have pots of money, and so have you, otherwise you wouldn't be huntable. There are those who would say we were well matched.
Including your mammy?
Especially the mammy. You want to be rid of men. Marry one.
I don't like idlers.
I'll go back to the law.
I don't like lawyers. They consort with criminals.
Oh, they don't. They consort with other lawyers.
That's what I said. Isn't there some family business selling bottled mineral water from the spa?
Yes, that's how we made our money, but the well dried up years ago.
We'll import some water. Better still, use ordinary water and whatever makes it taste disgusting.
My God, you're as crooked as any lawyer.
Our digest.
Elegant exchanges like that one spin the movie along very pleasantly for its first two-thirds. The Irish greenery is splendid, the period costumes and cars are lovely, and the acting is delicious. There even seems to be a plot afoot. The characters, played by Natasha Richardson and Mia Farrow, develop a steady but inexplicable hatred of one another, and soon strange things start happening that lead Farrow and the audience to believe that Richardson may be trying to murder her. So far, so good. But what the screenwriter Hugh Leonard is trying to do is pull the rug out from under us. The movie ends with a series of twists, but only the last one is as startling as he may have hoped. The developments before that range from the implausible to the utterly predictable. Still, Widow's Peak isn't a movie that anyone goes to for plot thrills. This is civilized entertainment for the crowds who feed on Merchant Ivory and Masterpiece Theater. And if Widow's Peak isn't quite as lofty a spot as Howard's End, it's still a much more refreshing place to spend an evening than, say, Bedrock.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Nancy Greenlease, Sue Spolin, and Jewel Bracey. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, America's first man in space. We talk with Alan Shepard. His first voyage in space lasted 15 minutes. That was in 1961. 10 years later, Shepard walked on the moon. He's co-authored a new book about America's race to the moon. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.